I'm Lindsay Claiborne.
And I'm Mumu Shu, and you are listening to Beyond the Microscope.
Hi everyone, it's Lindsay and Mumu back for another round of Beyond the Microscope. Today's guest is Alice Lee. She is the Assistant Director for Health and Sciences at the Harvard Innovation Lab. Thanks so much, Alice, for being on our show.
No problem.
All right, so let's start off. What exactly is the Harvard Innovation Lab and what is it that you do?
So the Harvard Innovation Lab, we're about 4 years old, and we are an educational collaborative at the Harvard at Harvard University, which means when you're listening to it, you're like, what does that mean? So I think like we've been trying to redefine ourselves as, or define ourselves as not an accelerator, not an incubator, because a lot of people assume that that's what we are. So we're basically a place that allows for students to come to us at any stage of their interest or involvement in entrepreneurship and see, basically help them take it to the next stage. So whatever they're at, if they're at the I'm curious about entrepreneurship, we try to kind of educate them there. If they have an idea, we try to get them to that next step. If they validated their idea and they're looking for funding, we try and help them. So whatever stage the student comes to us at, we try to get them to that next stage of understanding and learning. And if their venture doesn't kind of pan out, we still think that there's a lot of learning to be had that could be very valuable for what, regardless of what path they end up taking after school.
And so what is your job specifically?
So I oversee all the programming and advising for teams that are in the health and science space. It sounds really broad, and part of the reason is because we have a very small staff and we're trying to serve the entire school. So the Harvard Innovation Lab works with students from the college, from the business school, from the medical school, to the PhD programs. And so anything involving health and sciences, so healthcare could be, it could be the therapeutic drugs, it could be medical devices, but that also includes digital health and wearables. And then the sciences, you have sometimes engineering concepts, clean tech. We don't have that much clean tech right now, but if we had more teams, I would be overseeing that as well.
How did you get to this? I mean, what is your background to put you in this kind of position?
So I got my bachelor's of science in biological sciences from UC Irvine. And then after that, I got my PhD from Yale in developmental neurobiology. And while I was a grad student, I realized halfway through that research was probably not going to be my thing. As much as I love science, studying the same thing for almost 6 years was just not for me. I knew, thinking about my personality, I'm a people person. Just relatively speaking, I'm much more gregarious than what people typically think of as a PhD student. But then if you put me next to MBA students, I'm like the nerdy scientist. So it's all relative. Where I am right now was not something I planned. So I knew in grad school that I was not going to be a research scientist, and I became a McDougall Fellow. So at Yale, we have this graduate center called the McDougall Center, and it has graduate students planning different types of programming for other graduate students. And you get a little money on the side. So as a grad student with a small stipend, it's always nice to get, you know, a few $1,000 bonus on top of your stipend. And my last few years as a fellow, I was a career fellow. So it was really kind of exploration of like, what can you do with your PhD? And a lot of folks don't think about that until they graduate. And they're like, oh, crap, like, I don't want to be a postdoc or a professor. What do I do? So I had the benefit of starting to explore, and I just created programs about things that I was curious about. So I was basically doing exploration and getting paid for it as a fellow. I realized a lot of the things that I was doing, like creating this programming, I really enjoyed. And then the fact that I was paid for it was really cool. But I didn't even come to realize that that was a path for me to take until I took a trip to China. It was a school trip that the Chinese government paid for. And then Yale like took 100 people to go to China. Don't ask me why. The president of China like invited us.
No big deal.
But on that trip,
whatever.
I met
That just happened.
Yeah, so. It's just a long story. Well, the thing is, he came, invited 100 people, and then I didn't think anything of it. But then a year later, they put out a call for, hey, whoever wants to come to China for free, you should apply. And I like freaked out because I love traveling. But on that trip, I met a lot of administrators, and it was like through talking with them that I realized like I want to be in higher ed, but not in the context of doing research. And so I thought higher ed administration was something I want to explore more. And so I started looking into that. How I got into entrepreneurship or the iLab was that I've always been an intrapreneur. So wherever I am, I'm always thinking of like, what do we need? And then how am I going to build and get that for whatever population I'm working with? And so for the PhDs, I thought, you know, everyone does all this research and we publish papers, but nothing. It's so rare to see things kind of come out the other end and that has impact on society. So a lot of people publish a paper and they move on, and there's no realization of that research. So I felt that Yale needed to put more or invest more resources and money or people towards building that culture at the university. But I knew that they were going to, if I proposed it, they were going to ask me, well, what are our peer institutions doing? So preemptively, I decided to just go and do research on what they perceived as their peer institutions, which are like a lot of the Ivies. And while doing research, I came across the iLab, and they had a position posted for someone in the sciences. And they were actually looking for an entrepreneur that had created a company in the sciences, which I have not done, but I applied anyway. And then through conversations, I guess they thought that I had the entrepreneurial spirit, that I could pull it off. So they offered me the position, and that's why I'm here.
Everybody always sort of talks about, you know, it takes a certain type of person to be to run a startup or succeed in a startup. In the years you've been doing this kind of thing, do you see people that come in and you're like, yeah, that person's going to do it, and other ones you go, I don't know if they're going to cut it out? Do you have a sort of profile in your head?
I guess there's like, it's like leaders, right? Sometimes it was called predictive index. It's one of those assessments where you're like, how do you function in a team and how do you best interact and this, that, and the other thing. And we were talking about like, there are things that generally are perceived as positive, like, oh, being extrovert is positive. But you come to realize that like everyone, you can play to their strengths, and being an introvert doesn't mean that you can't be a good leader. It's just you lead in a slightly different way. So with entrepreneurship, I think there is an element of hustle that one needs, willingness to try. But then I think sometimes that can be coached as well. I think I work a lot with the scientists, and we are trained to not say anything until we are absolutely sure about it, right? Like, you don't publish a paper until your p-value is right. You wouldn't present at a conference if you were kind of unsure. Like, you would have side conversations, like, you know, over drinks at night. You're like, oh, I don't know how to interpret this data. But you don't present it, you know, in a public forum. And so a lot of the time there is this like fear of being wrong that like stops people from doing stuff. So a lot of the time when I'm talking to scientists, it's more like, just try, you know, go talk to people. Because we by default, and I found myself doing the same thing. When I first started, I was so afraid of not sounding like I knew what I was talking about that I would try to read everything that I could read. And my, my new like bosses were like, you know, you have a foundation. Like, I'm glad you did the research, but now it's time to talk to people.
Yeah, Lindsay tells me that all the time. She kind of, we were at a conference recently, mm-hmm. and she goes, kept telling me, go talk to that person, go talk to that person. I went, but science.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And I think it's about getting outside of that comfort zone. And I mean, I can completely empathize because I was on that side, right, where you just don't. For example, we have workshops and the speaker will say, here are the two here are two options. Indicate which one you would pick, option A, option B. And literally there is no wrong answer. It's really just how are you looking at the situation? What would you have chosen? And literally 80% of the room will abstain. Like, they don't even put up their hand because they're afraid that like, oh, if I put up my hand now and then it's actually the other answer. Oh, yeah. And no one cares. Literally nobody cares. Right. It's really just trying to gauge the room. And for me, it's a lot of the time trying to get them out of that space. And so different people, I think my role is like, depending on the person, I give them slightly different advice. So people who are really fearful of talking to people, I try to push them into that. Trying to test out, they're like, oh, well, there are papers published about it. I'm like, yeah, papers have published, but do you know how many papers are not reproducible? Like, that's an issue that we've come across now, right? Papers cannot be reproduced. And so you have to actually show that you can do it. Because also in science, we're really enamored with the concept of things, like the good idea, and you publish the paper and that's great. But then how are you going to realize that? So I hear some from scientists, they're like, oh, well, I did all the hard work, I did all the research, and now someone's going to make $1 billion off of my idea. I'm not trying to belittle the science. I think I know how much hard work science is, but we also have to appreciate that commercializing it and the execution of bringing an idea or this discovery into market is a whole different ball game. And so everyone is contributing in a different fashion, but it's all hard work. And so I try to play the conduit between these two worlds. Sometimes when I talk to the business folks, they are able to sell the vision, you know, very beautifully. But sometimes they're making promises that can't be kept. So they're talking about things that technologically are not possible at this point. And with the scientists, it's more, they're so focused on what they can currently do, and they don't want to overstate what they can do. They aren't able to sell the vision. And with entrepreneurship, it's a mix of both. It's about being able to articulate the vision, but also being able to, I guess, establish or define what the next 6 months looks like, what the next 12 months look like, what the next 18 months look like, and what the milestones you're trying to accomplish at each stage. And so there isn't, I think, one personality that will make it work. I think it's your willingness to adapt. Is if you're not willing to adapt, or if you see uncertainty just as paralyzingly frightening, then it probably won't work out either.
Have you noticed a certain trend of types of projects people are coming into this lab with? I mean, do you see waves of people, like everybody comes in going, we have to have the next wearable, or everyone comes in going, we have to have the next platform for this, or are people's ideas so diverse that you never see
No, I think that, we do get weird. So at the iLab, we see everything. So I oversee the sciences specifically, or health and sciences specifically, but we see startup or venture ideas that are in the consumer space, in the food space, in the kind of on-demand, kind of like Uber, like the Uber of whatever space. So there are definitely not copycats, but they take a concept and they try to tweak it for, so like the Uber of whatever, you could just fill in the blank. Like so many people have thought of that. In the sciences, I think I've been seeing a lot of kind of diagnostic genomic stuff, like sequencing, like the speed at which you sequence and the data that is, like the data science involved in interpreting kind of genomic sequences. And can you predict, like, let's say you have antibiotic resistance, or like just resistance in general. Can you predict that based off of genomic and data analysis or data science? When I put on my scientist hat, I could look at the technology and say, oh my gosh, that is super cool. But then I have to switch hats and then evaluate it on kind of the commercial feasibility or viability of it. So if you come to me and you're like, oh, I could sequence, you know, this, you know, I guess the whole genome of whatever virus in a fraction of the time. That sounds great. It's a technological advance. But like, what is the current technology or gold standard? And are you good enough to make anyone change the way that it's being done now? So if you're only like 10% faster or 10% cheaper, that's probably not going to do it. Like, people are not going to switch from whatever way they're doing it or the workflow that they're currently engaged in for something that is incrementally better. So it has to be tenfold better or tenfold cheaper. And even then, you still might have obstacles. It's not a trend in the types of ventures that I'm seeing, but I think that's just a learning that a lot of people have.
Is there a sort of star pupil or star team that has gone from conception to actually starting their own business?
So there's one team that I came in. So I've been at the iLab almost 3 years. One company that just recently raised, I think, a $10 million round, they're called Whoop, W-H-O-O-P. And they created a wearable that they're targeting in a very different market. So they're targeting elite athletes. So we're thinking like, you know, Olympians, NBA players, that kind of echelon. And that wearable, I haven't actually seen it myself, but there was a ESPN article about them, I think, a few weeks ago. The claim is that it's a 24/7 wearable. You don't have to charge it. So you just keep wearing it and it will record. And it's supposed to record physiological kind of measurements, like your heart rate, more accurately or as accurately as a chest strap. And so that's one of the features. And it was inspired, the two founders are two Harvard College students. And one of the founders or the CEO, I think, was a college athlete. I think he played squash. But he really,
of course he did.
Yeah, he wanted to, he wore a chest strap because he wanted to understand like why some days he felt the workout was great or why he was tired sometimes and like didn't know why. But he thought the chest strap was really uncomfortable. So that's how they embarked on this. They were kind of in stealth mode for 2 years. I mean, they raised funding without us even knowing. I only came across the funding because I tried to find their logo one day and came across the filing. But they are ones that are probably the furthest along in terms of wearables. But we've had a number of companies. So one other company called Aldatu, they are a diagnostic company to help figure out which drug regimen for HIV patients is best to use in case they have a drug-resistant strain of HIV. They are launching, or the technology was developed in the field in sub-Saharan Africa because the inventor was an instructor at the School of Public Health. And they came to me one day and they're like, we have this technology, but we're not really sure what to do with it. Or do we have a company or do we have a product? And so I remember like sitting down with them at an office hour chatting about that. And at the iLab, it's great that we have a lot of different opportunities for students to kind of test out their ideas. So they applied for our venture incubation program, which is a program for teams that have been working on the idea for a few months to get additional resources in addition to those that are available to all students. So mentorship, kind of VIP only dinners and workshops. And they applied for the Dean's Health and Life Sciences Challenge, which is this business proposal competition where you get to put your ideas on paper, get feedback from really established entrepreneurs and investors. They ended up winning that. And then they applied for an SBIR, which are government grants for commercializing science. And they applied for a phase two grant and got $1.5 million out of that. And then went on to win $250,000 from Verizon. Verizon has an annual competition called Powerful Answers. So all in all, they won probably close to $2 million within a year. Between me meeting them in office hours and a year later having won $2 million, and now they're at Lab Central, which is a co-working wet lab space, and they're building their company. So life sciences, it takes a little longer, but the progress that they made in a short period of time is pretty impressive.
Do you miss doing your own science, or do you sort of live vicariously through these people?
I knew even as a grad student, I like brainstorming. So I like thinking about what people are doing and then trying to help them design, like, how do you best arrive to an answer. So that has always been the most fun for me. I didn't actually like doing the experiments because I feel like my happiest and saddest moments were always in a really dark room. So either like the microscopy room or like developing a Western blot. And so that was just not a good fit for my personality. People ask me if I miss doing experiments. And I think I do a lot of experiments, or I help design a lot of experiments with the students, a slightly different type. But even the science ones, if they're talking about like, oh, what is the next proof point? I'm thinking beyond the science again. Like now I feel like I have an extra lens to evaluate what they're doing. So if someone's doing a therapeutic, so we have a team that is doing a cancer therapeutic. And for me, it's like, okay, so does this eliminate the tumor entirely or does it shrink it? Is this a combination with another drug or another chemotherapy? So I'm always stepping back to think about how does it fit into the grand scheme of things? Because if if you're a drug, a therapeutic for cancer and you only break it, like let's say it's 90%, is 90% good enough? If it's not, it's like, okay, you got it down to 90%, you extended their life, but they're still going to die. So it's kind of trying to help them think outside of the science, even though I still ask them questions about science and like, oh, so how many candidates are you going to screen? And, you know, how are you going to decide on which candidate to pursue and that kind of stuff? So I do talk about science, but there's always that extra layer now.
So when I was an undergrad at Harvard about 10 years ago, I remember being an engineer, me and my friends would go to the Career Center and sort of ask them, what are our options for after college? And we'd always get the stock answer of consulting. And we said, no, we don't want to do consulting.
Yeah.
We want to maybe go into engineering. And they'd say, investment banking. We're like, no. And those were kind of the only options that we were really given.
Yeah, I just heard that a few days ago. I find it shocking that that's what, I mean, well, the career office has a ton of people and their default answers are those two. Like, are you serious? Like, that's weird.
So you still heard that's still the case?
I don't know. I don't remember who I heard it from, but, oh yeah, okay. It was from another engineering student. Someone was asking, yes. Like, oh, what are you going to do next, like, after you graduate? He's like, oh, no, yeah, you're going to, maybe that wasn't the career office, but they're like, oh, you're going to investment banking. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, why did I just ask you that question when I know the answer? I'm like, really? But.
Right, so that was sort of the stock response that we always got. And so I'm really surprised and excited to hear, I had no idea about the Harvard Innovation Lab. So how do you know sort of how it started and why it started and the impetus for that?
Yeah, this is hearsay because I wasn't here when it all started. But I heard it was, so George Whitesides is a professor at Harvard, and he wrote this white paper about basically promoting the concept of smart people being able to put their ideas to use. So it's kind of like, let's get practical. Like, you have an idea, but how do you, you know, we have smart people at this school. How do we empower them or give them the tools to realize ideas? And so that was a kind of a white paper that came out. George Lasseter, who was a faculty chair, he just recently retired, but he went around the university and got buy-in from, you know, professors and the faculty and the deans of the schools, not by saying, oh, we're going to create a place that churns out a bunch of companies, but no, this is a place where students can come and learn how to put their ideas to use. And that's really kind of the ethos at the iLab. You know, for us, of course, having successful ventures spin out is something we love to see, but that's not our main objective. If a student tries it and they don't succeed, we think they'll have skills that they can use later. Or if they try it and they're like, this is not for me, at least they know they've tried it. So instead of wondering what if, they're like, yeah, that's just not for me. Like, it's not a good fit for how I like to work. It's too chaotic, or there's too much uncertainty, and I just don't deal well in that situation. And so then they can choose to, you know, do other things. But there are a lot of skills that are transferable. And the iLab exists also that students can try these things in a safe space. So when they graduate, they can make a more informed decision of whether or not they would want to go full time on this venture or not. So if you try it in school and you fail, no big deal. And if you try it and it's going well, you have more information to decide, okay, yeah, I think I'm going to go full time and not question my, well, they're going to question, but be a little bit more confident. entrepreneurship, I think when they say it's a roller coaster, I mean, I'm not even doing it with them and I can feel it. Like, there are days where
you feel the trauma.
Well, the extent of highs and lows. And it's within a 24-hour period or maybe even a 6-hour period where you come out of a great meeting or you like had a great sales call or something. And then 3 hours later, it's like a punch in the gut where something else happens. And I'm sure other jobs have that too. And that's why we have, the iLab is a nice place for other entrepreneurs because it can be very lonely if you don't have like a large team or like even a co-founder. And so we're here to lend a shoulder, I guess. If a student has a bad day or, you know, is really questioning what they're doing or if they should continue, that's something that they can freely share with us, because we don't take equity in the company. We don't, like, we're not investing in these companies. If they tell us bad news, we're not going to, like, all of a sudden take away or, like, call somebody and tell, like, you know, basically blow their story to someone else. Like, for us, we play therapists a lot of the time as well.
What's your business model? How do you guys get paid?
We get paid. So we don't take sponsorships either. So a lot of places have a lot of corporate sponsors. That's not how Harvard does it. Harvard is very good at finding donors. So we are funded by donors and the university, which I know is not a business model that is a luxury that not many other places have. But that's, you know, we've had corporate folks approach us to try and give us funding. They're like, oh, can we sponsor this part of, you know, your challenge? Or can we sponsor this or that? And I actually have to turn them down because we don't take it. Because I think, I don't know in the future if that will change. But my suspicion is that earlier on, when you take sponsorship from folks, you kind of, even though they say no strings attached, I think there's some expectation that you know, at least consult them on what you do or how it aligns with their interests.
The best ideas go to them first.
Yeah, exactly. Like something like that, where they're trying to get some sort of insider advantage or like first mover advantage or something like that. And I think that earlier on, maybe part of the motivation or their thought was to, let's just do it the way we would do it without outside influence. And again, you know, we probably wouldn't be able to do that if we were at other places that didn't have a large coffer and a very strong donor base from the alumni.
Let's say I were a student and I had in my engineering class and I thought I had the newest, greatest drone technology and I wanted to start my own company. And I come to you. What advice would you give me?
I think the advice that we generally give a lot of folks when they come to us with an idea is understanding what is already out there, understanding who your competition is, and understanding and talking to who you think your end user or customer is. Not assuming that they know that they would want it, but actually talking to them. And even then, you have to kind of test it. A lot of people don't want to be the someone who rains on someone's parade. It's like, nah, not interested. So a lot of people will say, oh, that sounds interesting, or oh, that sounds cool. Like, you want reactions that are much stronger than that. Like, oh my gosh, why does that not exist? I would totally buy that. And even then, it's still not, like, you probably have to, you know, have some prototype and have them test it out. But a lot of folks think that if I build it, they will come, or if I build it, they will buy it, which is a very poor assumption. So advice is talk to more people. A lot of people, another thing is people are really afraid of people. Students are afraid, or not just students, folks who are thinking about ideas are really worried about someone stealing their idea. And after you've been in this world a little while, you realize the idea, a lot of people have similar ideas. It's actually who's going to execute on it best.
Just because somebody else has already said it doesn't mean it's not a lost cause on your, you know, for your idea.
Yeah, and the thing is knowing how you're different. Because some people like will come to my office hours, tell me something, and then they haven't even Googled it to know, see if anyone has ever done it. And so I will sit there and Google it in for them and then turn my computer around like, do you mean this? And they're like, oh yeah, kind of. I'm like, that's fine. How are you different? So if there are things, I'm not saying that if it exists already that you shouldn't bother. It's more like you should know how you're different and how you're going to be better, or why you will succeed and they will fail. It's just knowing, doing your homework. Don't assume that you're the only genius who thought about it.
Well, I think that's all the questions that we have. Alice, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This is fantastic. Really interesting stuff about entrepreneurship.
Like our show? Find out more at scopepodcast.com and follow us online on Facebook and Twitter at Scope Podcast. This is Lindsay Claiborne
and Moo Moo Shu.
Our theme music was composed by The Copycuts. Thanks for listening.